Welcome to another edition of the First Intuition podcast. On this episode, we talk all things audit. What is it like to work in audit? Why is it important to study it? And why the skills that we learn doing an audit transfer to lots of areas of accounting and finance. We're joined by special guest Ginny Bradwell to discuss the topic, and we did the session in front of a live Zoom audience. If you'd like to join a future session, you can register for them in the show notes. Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the First Intuition Student Podcast and Forum. My name is Ben Bullman, and I'm joined again this evening by my good friend, colleague, and fellow director, David Malthouse. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave. How are you this week, Ben?
Really good. Thank you, Dave. Well, I say really good. Regular listeners will know I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I think, that I'd slipped over and had fractured my ankle. And I thought all was healing very, very nicely, but went to a consultant yesterday who took a further x-ray and informed me that I'm highly likely to need an operation. And so I've been called this morning, and I think I've got to go in for an op on Friday this week to put a rather disgusting sounding metal plate into my ankle and push the bones back together. But we won't talk any more about that. But that's soured my week somewhat, which had started as a fantastic week because I got to see you and we had a lovely lunch in the sunshine on Friday, Dave.
I mean, Friday was really nice. It was really great to catch up face to face rather than through a screen. And yeah, we did find a delightful country pub halfway between Chelmsford and Cambridge, and it was really, really good, really nice to kind of the thing I really liked about it, and I took a bit of time to get used to, was the fact that it was meeting up without an agenda. Because it's always when you're doing a Zoom, you're meeting up because you've got an agenda to talk about something. But it was nice just to catch up and just find out how things were going and discuss what was going on in your office, discuss what was going on in my office, you know, talk about students and progress and exams and all that kind of great, really, really good stuff that you'd normally talk about if you were in an office together, or, you know, if you popped out for lunch at break times and things like that. So it was really nice to make time for that. And I'm hopeful that we're going to be repeating again next month if your ankle's up to it, where I believe it's my turn to pay and your turn to choose a place to meet at.
Fantastic. And Dave, being the culinary expert that he was, did take us to a lovely venue and apparently a former haunt of celebrity chef Jamie Oliver, which was really cool to find out. So it was lovely. Absolutely lovely. And the sun was shining, which made a big change and a difference. We were able to sit outside.
Yeah, it was really, really nice.
That was fantastic. So other than that, the other thing that happened yesterday, before I went to my hospital appointment, I called into our Cambridge office because we had the most students in the building we have had for a couple of years. We had over 100 students coming in for courses and exams yesterday. And me being the nosy so-and-so I am, I like to be in just to make sure things are going as they should be. And I was really, really pleased. It was a lovely atmosphere. It was so nice to see some new students coming in for their first courses. We had some AAT Level 3 programs starting yesterday, which was the first study units that some of the students had done. And I had a really nice morning, albeit hobbling around in reception, but welcoming students and pointing them in the directions of the various classrooms that they needed to attend. So what's been happening in your world, Dave, apart from meeting me for lunch this Friday?
Apart from meeting you for lunch, which was obviously the highlight, I'm still carrying my sporting injury, Ben, so I'm unable to do any form of exercise. I went to see an osteopath, which was probably the most pain I've ever been in or had inflicted on me for quite some time. And I think my leg's been hurting more since I saw him than it was when I went to see him. And with trepidation, I'm going to see him again tomorrow. So I'm not looking forward to my next appointment with Nero, the osteopath, but I'll let you know how that goes on. But other than that, from the point of view of being at work, I feel very similarly to you. We're getting lots of students coming into our centre, lots of new students that have never been there before. And I know last time I talked about kind of a big induction day that happened and we had loads of people on site. This week's been just as busy. It's been really nice to see people start their AAT studies and coming out of their budgeting unit, being hopefully infused and ready to apply what they've known in the workplace. So it's just nice to get that buzz of being in a busy teaching centre again, I think.
100%. It was such a lovely feeling. and really nice to see the students. I think they were genuinely grateful to be back in a classroom. And let's hope we are now back to, dare I say it, a more normal routine for classroom delivery. Let's bring in our guest at this point. So we're joined tonight by another tutor and director at First Intuition and friend of the podcast, we can now call her, because when you get to come back for a second time, Ginny, we can call you a friend of the podcast.
I'm changing my email signature as we speak, Ben. I love that.
Ginny Bradwell, welcome. How's your week been, Ginny?
My week has been great, thank you. I have been lucky to be teaching a six-day accounting course. And it's very rare that I get to meet people at the start of their qualification. So I reminded myself that debits are on the left and credits are on the right. So that was all good. And then I went off and I spent 3 days learning how to be an Ofsted inspector. So I'm very excited about that as well. So lots of good stuff going on. That's as well as the day job. That's not instead of my day job. So I will stay being a tutor and director in FI.
That's Ginny Bradwell, tutor, director, and now Ofsted inspector as well.
And friend of the podcast. That's the most important change to my job title, I think, Dave.
And we're going to be talking about auditing a little bit later on, but do your auditing skills, do you feel that they'll be used as part of your duties as an Ofsted inspector?
I think so, because it's about evidence and not basing an opinion on gut feel. It's about understanding what quality of evidence you've got in front of you, and it's about using that to make the right decisions and the right outcomes. So yeah, very much a transferable skill.
Ginny, I've got to ask, do you get issued with any form of badge or identification?
I have a badge, Ben.
You can flash just to kind of get privileged access.
I don't know I get privileged access. I don't know that it gets me the table in Jamie Oliver's restaurants, but I do have a badge. Very excited.
So we're going to be talking about audit tonight, something that I've done in my career, and I know Ginny has as well, and we've both taught. And in fact, I think I said last time Ginny was a guest of the podcast, my first introduction to a First Intuition class was sitting in one of Ginny's advanced audit and assurance classes when I was learning my stuff to go and teach it back in Cambridge. Dave, you have worked in audit, but you've maybe got slightly less of a passion for it than me and Ginny, which I think will probably come across this evening on the episode.
Yeah, absolutely. I trained as an auditor. I worked in audit for about 4 years before I saw the light, and then moved to the other realms of accountancy, shall we say, and then finally became a tutor. So I know what it is to conduct an audit. I've never been important enough to sign audit reports or ever get to that kind of level, though.
So I don't know where we wanted to start this evening, but I guess an obvious place to start is really thinking about what is an audit. And it's quite an umbrella term, isn't it? So Ginny, maybe we'll start with you. If you were summing up audit to an alien that landed in sunny Luton or Bedfordshire, what would we describe it as?
I think we'd describe it as giving an opinion on something, but based on evidence and having the right amount of evidence. So it's not just going in going, yeah, that looks about okay. You've actually done some work to support the opinion that you're going to give. That's my alien guide to auditing.
Fantastic. And it's something we teach, isn't it? That it's a wider term is assurance, providing assurance on something. And predominantly we teach it on financial reporting and financial records, but it's a much bigger subject than that, isn't it? We can provide assurance on lots of things.
Absolutely. And you know, my career has been involved spending time in Luton Town Football Club. And the FA, as part of their sharing funding for youth football, actually send out auditors to have a look to ensure that funding is being spent appropriately. So it's being spent just on youth football. So again, that's that idea of ensuring that what's happening is what the FA were being told is happening. So we go, I've got a football example in there pretty early on there, Ben.
I was actually doing some Googling. I woke up really early this morning and thought, are we going to talk about audit tonight? Let me just Google audit or go on. What I quite often do is go onto the BBC News website and just type in a subject and see what pings up and thinking, oh, there might be some good articles. And the one that really caught my eye as I was having my first cup of tea this morning at about 5:30 was the fact that somebody has commissioned an audit of the Union Terrace Gardens granite, which is a big stately home building up in Aberdeen. And they've had some construction work done and some of the very valuable granite from their steps has disappeared. And they've had to bring in an external body to do an audit of how much granite should be there and where has it gone, which was the most different kind of audit and assurance that I came across, particularly this morning at 5:30 when I was having a cup of tea.
I must admit, I've counted many things on stock takes in my life, Ben, but I've never counted granite.
See, I have actually counted granite on a stock take.
Have you?
I did a stock take for a funeral parlour, and a connected business was they made headstones. And actually, Ben, you'll probably know this because it was the funeral parlour in Cambridge. That's as you drive out of Cambridge past the football stadium, there's a funeral parlour out that way. And at the back in their workshop, they've got massive slabs of granite. And I actually count how many slabs of granite they had in various different colours. All I remember is I came back and my suit was just covered in dust from like granite and marble that had been ground up everywhere. And to be honest, I'm not 100% certain I knew the difference between every single different shade of granite. So I'm pretty sure I know how much granite they had, but whether it was the rose granite or the light pink granite, I'm not 100% sure that I categorized it correctly.
Well, leading on from that, I counted coffins in a Letonian undertaker. So there we go. It's obviously one of the things that you get the trainees to go away and do.
Yeah, we had coffins as well. So you didn't have any work in progress that you had to to determine.
Was no there work in progress, but it was a funeral parlour that also is a building firm. So it's my example when I'm teaching matching and seasonality, because in the winter they have very little building, but more funerals. And then in the summer, it goes the other way around. So there we go. So you offset, and so you make sure your workforce is busy at all times.
It's odd because the funeral had a very similar thing. They also, they did granite for headstones and that, but they also did work surfaces for kitchens as well, which was how they diversified that business.
Best bacon sandwich I ever had was there, because if you've got big people needing their building, that, you know, they like their 11s, and it was the best 11s ever.
This sounds like a rather geeky game of auditor top trumps. What's the most unusual thing that you've had to go and count or observe at a stock take? So have we got any advance on granite, Ginny? What's the most obscure thing that you've had to go and pretend you really understand to quantify their inventory in a set?
Well, I'm going to go in with what I think is the winner, which is bull's semen. I had to count bull's semen, which, if you're unsure of, is stored in dry ice, so it can't come out for long because then it degrades. But yeah, I counted that.
I think you've beaten me. I don't really know where to go with that one, Ginny. I'm sure there's something I could say that was extremely witty and funny, but I'm not even going to bother, to be honest. I just think we'll pause there. We could end the podcast on that one.
I think so. And it's at that point that I decided that possibly I wanted to change my career, I think. So here I am as an FI tutor.
So all joking aside, I think there are some students and some listeners to this that work in audit or will go on to work in audit, but a lot of our students won't. So I suppose that the next place to go would be, why do we think it's important? Let's go back from the exam perspective to start with. Ginny, audit comes up in lots of different syllabuses, doesn't it?
It does. So it's there in AAT as a optional unit, but it's also part of the Level 4 Synoptic. It's in CEMA in a number of different papers, but so it sort of bookends, really. So it's quite prevalent in BA4 for CEMA, and then it comes back again at P3. It's in the ICAW syllabus, and it's in ACCA, both as a skill, a knowledge paper and skills paper, and then again as an optional paper in advanced audit and assurance. So pretty much there is a chance you are going to be touched by audit at some point through your qualification.
Whether you like it or not, want to or not, yes. And I think that's an observation I would have as a tutor. I think two things I would stress there. One, it tends to be more ACCA. It's a mandatory whole exam in ACCA. And a lot of ACCA students will say, I don't work in audit and I probably never will. Why do I have to do an exam in it? And we can maybe cover that separately. But the second point I wanted to raise was the AAT level 4, because at that point it's a choice. And you might be sitting there thinking, why would I ever choose audit, particularly if I'm never going to work in audit? So shall we start there? Why do you think it might still be a good option to consider at AAT, even if you don't work in audit directly?
I mean, it's a great paper. The external audit paper at level 4 is a great insight into how organisations are structured, how they have systems and controls. Because actually, what's an audit? An audit looks at the set of accounts and kind of works backwards and says, how did those numbers get there? So to understand the accounts, the byproduct, you've actually got to understand the business. So it's a brilliant starting point, and it hugely helps people in the synoptic as well at level 4, which then also brings in things like businesses and systems. So lots of transferable knowledge on those two papers.
I can see Dave semi-switching off and glazing over there, but you just got me really excited. What you were talking about there is an audit trail.
And it is.
If you like to be an explorer or an investigator, I think following an audit trail is fascinating. To take it from a number in the accounts, well, where does that number come from? Or something we used to call directional testing when I was doing it, picking something that was there, an order, and saying, right, I now need to follow that through and see how it has manifested itself in a sales or a purchase number in the financial statements. Brilliant stuff. You're getting me almost thinking, God, I wouldn't mind going back to do an audit.
Well, I was also lucky enough, having been an FD, I also sat the other side of the desk. So when our external auditors came out, and again, this was in a football club, and one of the things they asked to do was to physically verify, because we like long words in audit, which basically means go and look at. And they wanted to go and look at the upper tier of the main stand in Luton Town's ground. And they didn't know where it was. So I had to point out that it was probably outside, not inside, because they were walking around inside looking for the tier for the seats.
Wow. that feeling of power, I guess you must have on the other side of an audit, thinking, I know more about what you're asking me than you know about why you're asking it of me.
Which for listeners to the podcast is another really good reason to understand audit. Even if you're never going to be an auditor, at some point, if you're going to work in industry, you're going to come across these people. So if you can speak their language, if you understand what it is that they're going to be doing, it just helps you to communicate more effectively with them.
So, I mean, I can understand the thought process of an auditor thinking that a club like Luton probably doesn't need two tiers of seats. So they're a bit sceptical as to whether it exists and they might need to find it.
Harsh, Mr. Malthouse.
Let's just go back to my first point. And Dave, interested to hear your comments on this one as well. What's your standard response to a student of ACCA that says, why do I have to do a whole exam paper in audit if I've got no intention of working in audit for any point of my career?
Well, I don't use a lot of the technical terminology that you two use, because I'm someone that gave up on audit quite some time ago. So I kind of look at audit as it, someone's telling you something and you're trying to show that what they're telling you is about right. So if you're a finance director and your sales manager comes in and says, I think that we're going to make £10 million worth of sales. But if you've got some kind of auditing skills, you can sense check as to whether we think that's about right or not. You can look at, you know, does that tie up with the trends that you'd expect to see? Is that wildly out from what we maybe did in the prior couple of seasons? What are the assumptions that it's made? How many, you know, what are the trends in terms of our existing products, new products? And get an idea as to, is this person really giving you an accurate forecast, or is this forecast absolutely miles off? I know that one of the things that you auditors love to talk about is doing the doing kind of like a little bit of analysis of P&L and looking at ratios and things like that. Now, I know you guys do it to say, well, is there a risk there could be misstatements if margins have changed and things like that? That's something that I think you should do if you're running a business anyway. If your margin is wildly different this month compared to last month, either something's fundamental has changed in your business or someone's done something wrong and there's an error in those accounts. It's the first check as to whether someone has done something correctly or not. So I think there are lots of skills you can use. I particularly like the thing that Ginny said about systems. If you work for a big company, you will have lots of systems. You need to understand why those systems exist, and you need to recognize what the weaknesses could be and be able to say, are there any improvements we need to make? If there are changes, things like that. If you work for a small business, well, if your small business is growing, you're going to need to start putting processes and systems in place to ensure as you get bigger, the infrastructure of the business moves with you. And again, understanding from an audit perspective what auditors would look at, I think is really going to help you to put the right processes in place. So I do think there are skills that are transferable. It's just I really don't want to do auditing anymore in the big bad world.
I often say to students, no business exists to prepare that set of accounts. And once you start to think that the accounts are only ever a byproduct of anything you do, which is bound to be more exciting than doing the accounts, then auditing is just a fantastic way to see lots of different businesses. I was very lucky in my career to audit some huge, you know, FTSE listed companies, but also tiny hat manufacturers. I'm a Luton girl, that's why Luton Town's called the Hatters, home of the hat trade. And I was shown around how you make a hat. It's just a phenomenal experience. I feel like I should be recruiting for audit firms. I should see if I can get on commission. But it does give you the opportunity to see lots of companies and to see absolutely anything within those companies. Nothing's off limits if you're the auditor.
Let's maybe break it down a bit. From what you guys have just said, I think that there are a few particular skills that we can maybe do a bit of a dive into. The first one, and it's an interesting, we've just had a comment from a live student in the chat box tonight saying, ratios, I hate the ratios. It kind of links in with Dave's first point there about doing what me and you, Ginny, would call analytical review and analytical procedures. That's us using our auditor dictionary. Ginny, maybe you could share with us what you understand and how you would explain analytical review to a student.
Absolutely. I always start by saying analytical review is having an expectation of what you think you will see. So, for example, if I was auditing a football club at the moment, I would expect this year's revenue to be lower than last year's revenue. That's my expectation because there was a pandemic and there were no matches. So that's my expectation. I would then look at this year's revenue to last year's revenue. And if it's gone up, I would be really surprised because that's not in line with my expectation. And therefore, I would have to go and do a lot more work on why that revenue's gone up. Now, if it's gone down, that's what I expected. It's in line with my expectation. Therefore, I've got a degree of comfort. Dave used the expression, you know, are you happy that this is about right? That stacks up. That's about right. And therefore, I'm more comfortable with what's in front of me.
That was a lovely explanation. I thought you were going to make a gag about Derby there and their particular state of affairs, but we won't go there this week.
Having been a fan of a club that's been in administration three times, I'm not going to pile on to Derby there.
But it follows on quite nicely from doing that analytical review. So you've got an expectation that it should look like this based on your understanding of the business, of the wider environment that it's operating. Then I guess the second word I was going to use is substantive. And I always explain that as what it means to substantiate it. What's going to back that up? So that's where we talk about substantive testing, Ginny. But what's your way of explaining that to a student?
Yeah, absolutely. So to substantiate something is to almost prove it, if you like. So if I'm looking at a set of accounts and I can see the top line under property, plant and equipment says yacht, I'm going to need to go and substantiate the yacht because, you know, how do I know they've got a yacht? And there's lots of things I could do. I could go and see it. That's great. I could see an invoice for the yacht. I could maybe see the money going out of the bank account to a supplier called Yacht. And But all of the time, I'm just getting more comfort that that yacht is there. I understand how much they've paid for it. It does belong to the organisation. And I'm substantiating all of the things that I can assume based on seeing one line in a statement of financial position or balance sheet.
Exactly right. And the one thing I always then encourage students to think about is the practicalities of doing that. Could you go and verify every member of staff on the payroll? Well, no, because you'd be there till next Christmas, let alone this Christmas. One of the words that I try to ingrain in students, and I always make a bit of a joke with students, if you're sitting an audit exam, you need to sound like an auditor. You probably wouldn't want to admit that in polite company on a Friday night when you're out in town. You don't want to sound like an auditor. But for the hour and a half of your exam, you need to sound like an auditor. And one way you can sound like an auditor is by saying we would test a sample of things. And that's something else we cover. I draw on that from my own previous experience. Regular listeners, if you've listened to my podcast where I talk about my background, I did geography at A level and liked geography because part of it was doing a project report where, and I actually picked mine on pebbles on beaches in Norfolk, which was a pretty cool field trip when you were 18. But doing sampling, you would sample things. I couldn't test every beach or in Norfolk or every pebble on that beach. But I could pick samples and then use that to project my findings over this might be happening. And I always think back to that geography field trip and the report I did thinking, do you know what? That was a pretty good start to my career as an audit tutor or an auditor as I was before I started teaching. So thank you, Ginny. That's substantive testing. I'm going to use another word now. And I'm going to say Dave is looking pretty skeptical tonight at our love and passion of audit. But I always think the word skepticism is actually used a lot now in the audit exams and something that across the profession, I think, has been signposted as something that whether you're an auditor or not, a good financial professional should be skeptical. I don't mean skeptical in your challenging of the love of audit, Dave, but Ginny, how do you explain skepticism to your classes?
Skepticism is something that we all use. We use it every day, but just because it's in an audit exam, it's still the same skill. So if somebody sends you an email and says, congratulations, you have won a lottery prize. Now, I know you haven't bought a ticket, but you've been picked. All you need to do is pop your bank details on this email and you have won £500,000. And every single one of us would sit there and go, yeah, I don't think that's right. And I don't think it's right because I didn't buy a lottery ticket because they haven't got my name right. And there's no way on this planet I'm going to hand over my bank details. That's the skill of skepticism. It's about not taking stuff at face value to think before you act. So if somebody asked me, for example, what's the best football club in the championship? Well, you should be skeptical about my answer. I'm biased. I'm going to tell you Luton Town every time. And therefore, again, skepticism says, let me just think, why is she saying that? Is there anything that's driving that answer? So that skepticism in an audit, all we're saying is, therefore, when your client waves a piece of paper in front of you, be skeptical. There was a brilliant article in a couple of papers yesterday, actually, following on from the Patisserie Valerie fraud. And it talked about this idea of skepticism. They showed how Patisserie Valerie's sales had come in across the year. And one of the ways the fraud was perpetuated was booking a load of sales from the sales of gift vouchers for afternoon tea. And actually, when you looked at the afternoon tea voucher sales, about 90% of them came in the last 2 weeks of the financial year. That's a bit odd, isn't it? Because I would expect people enjoy afternoon tea throughout the year pretty equally. I wouldn't expect there to be a massive rush in the last 2 weeks just before the year end. And that's the idea of skepticism. That's the skill of going, yeah, this looks a bit weird. This isn't what I expect to see.
Dave, I hope you would agree that being skeptical is a good trait in a finance professional, something you would look for in members of your team, maybe.
I'm not sure about that, Ben.
uh,
Yes, I agree. I do agree. It's something that I was actually teaching some apprentices today, and one thing we talked about was cybercrime, and something we did talk about is being skeptical when you receive those emails. And you know, they can look very, very convincing. Not as convincing, obviously, as Ginny's, you've won the lottery. But we've all heard of those emails that appear to come from your chief executive that are saying, oh, please can you wire the money to this supplier by close of play today? And it all seems very convincing. And you know, one of the things we did talk about was just taking that step back and saying, is this really something that a CEO is likely to contact me about? Is it legitimately from them? Is there another way that I can verify it? So I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to speak to them and say, you just sent me this email just to say to pay £20,000. Did you really want me to pay it? Did you actually send it to me? Because it's just, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about doing it. And just, yeah, absolutely showing that degree of skepticism, you know, when something comes through that just doesn't feel right.
We had our chief exec who was... account had been hacked, and that one of those emails was sent, and I knew it was not right because of the way it said hiya. I was like, yeah, that's definitely not right. That was my skepticism.
We're talking lots about football tonight, which usually happens when me and Dave and Ginny are together, but I saw Chris Kamara, Cammy was on telly last week, and I managed to catch him, and he's been subject to a hack. And it had emailed lots of people in his emails. And I guess being the celebrity that he is now, he's got lots of people in his email address book. And a few of them were being sceptical of the email that they'd received, but a few hadn't been. So I think that's a particularly hot topic. The final one of the skills, and I think we're winning Dave round, Ginny.
I think
really
we are.
See that he's warming to the need for knowing this stuff, whether or not you're going to pursue a career in audit or not.
I think Warren's pushing it, maybe tepid.
Tepid, okay. We've still got a few minutes to turn him round. The final bit that I wanted to talk about with regards to the main skills we see, and a big chunk of the syllabus that we teach in an audit course, is around professional ethics. And we've kind of dabbled in bits on it today, but why do you think the world of audit is more ripe for the need to be ethical?
I think it comes down to trust. People trust auditors. So HMRC trust an auditor's self-accounts as a basis of forming some discussion around tax liability. Companies trust a set of accounts to decide whether or not to lend money or to extend lines of credit. And so with that trust, I feel like I sound a little bit like Yoda, but you know, with trust comes responsibility, that you have to behave in such a way that trust can be placed in you. If people can't trust you as the auditor because you don't know how to behave as an auditor, then you've got a real problem. I've just been told it's Spider-Man. Is it, John? Thank you. I'm really, really rubbish. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but I'm not very good at my Spider-Man. But yeah, that to me is the important thing, that if you want people to trust your work and you know that people are relying upon you, then you have to behave in a set way. That's the price for all of the glamour and excitement that a career in auditing can bring you, which Ben and I know to be true.
And I always get students to think about it from the external perspective, looking back in. It's one thing you saying, well, I'm ethical. Of course, I would do the right thing in any scenario. But I think the additional spotlight and scrutiny that auditors are in, it's not necessarily what you've done. It's the perception of what might have happened to the outside world.
Absolutely. I always say to people, it's not what it is, it's what it looks like. And I tell a story about my daughter's hockey coach. And my daughter's hockey coach and I were seen in a pub together. Now, that's fine, because I knew him, I knew his wife, and everybody knew everybody. It was all fine. But one of my husband's friends, who didn't know the hockey coach, sent my husband a message going, I've just seen your wife in a pub in London with another man. And it was that idea that it wasn't what it was. It was what it looked like to that person, because they hadn't taken steps to try and understand what was going on. And that's, you know, that's the example of, you know, the importance of ethics. Do you actually, you know, are you behaving in such a way that anybody walking past can go, that's what I expect to see? Somebody who doesn't know what's going on, what do they think when they look in and see?
I usually talk about a real life example for me. So people that have studied audit or are studying audit, you'll know, and we've just had it in the chat box mentioned, the threats to your independence and remaining objectively independent to the organization you're auditing is vital to be a credible auditor and to do it ethically. And one of the things you'll come across in your studies is gifts and hospitality, that old favorite. And we always talk about gifts and hospitality can be accepted if they are modest, Ginny, which always means probably something you wouldn't bother wanting to have in the first place. If you're going to accept it, it's modest, it's probably something that you're thinking, why would I even want that?
It's a pen, isn't it, Ben? It's a pen or it's a cheap bottle of wine.
In the firm I work for, we used to do the audit of a business, and the business owned a villa in the Caribbean, and it was all above board, but they would offer it out, and offering it out to members of their own team and staff was absolutely fine. As long as all the tax was correctly declared, that was absolutely fine. But every year when I was the senior manager on the assignment, and I did it for a good 3 years, they would say to me, Ben, oh, look, there's a calendar over there. And if you go and put crosses on the week that you and your wife want, you can go and use the villa in the Caribbean. And as much as I would have loved it, they always made it clear I'd have to pay for my flights. And I thought, well, I can deal with that. If I'm getting a free villa in the Caribbean, that would be lovely. But every year I had to decline it. We had very strict rules at the firm. And certainly anyone that has studied audit would know that would clearly not be deemed modest. And I don't think anything funny was going on. I genuinely don't think they were trying to influence me. And I would like to think, being the upstanding professional I am, I wouldn't have been influenced by it. But all I then end that story with in class is, I have now been out of the firm and audit world for coming up for 9 years, and they've never picked up the phone to me since I've not been their auditor saying, Ben, which week do you want the villa in the Caribbean? So maybe there was more to it. Who knows?
It's not what it is, Ben, it's what it looks like.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Ginny. That's a really nice insight into some of the key skills. But clearly, the world of audit doesn't come without some scandal. And particularly in recent weeks, you've already mentioned Patisserie Valerie. I don't think we'll name individual firms of auditors, but when I was doing my search in this morning, as soon as you search it, you will find lots of media articles that talk about what's going on out there in the world and fines for auditors. Why do you think there maybe has been more of this in the public media in recent years?
I think people are trying to ensure that firms who get it wrong are seen to face a sanction. So to encourage firms to ensure that they've got good, well-trained staff, that those staff have the time that's needed to gain enough evidence. That, you know, that's why, because it goes back to that idea of trust. You know, if I, as a member of the public, if I see audit firms getting it wrong and just escaping with a sorry, won't do it again, I don't really feel as an outsider that that's going to change behaviour. But if I see a firm getting it wrong and then being slapped with a very large fine, I have more faith that that's going to change the behaviour of the audit firms. As you said, let's not name them, but you can pick any large audit firm and a Google search will find at least 1, 2, 3 examples of where they get it wrong.
And I think the fines, obviously, amounts of money are relative. To me, sitting here this evening in my kitchen, the fine I saw for Patisserie Valerie's auditors looks substantial. I think 2.3 million. 2.3 million has been quoted in the press this week as the amount the firm have been fined. There was another firm fined 3.5 million back in August for another failed audit. So not insignificant sums of money, but I think also the fact that it makes the BBC news actually adds to the reputational damage to the profession as well. So it's kind of a double whammy, not just the financial kick, but also the fact that you're going to be mentioned in dispatches.
Yeah, you are. And there's no surprise that those of you studying things like advanced audit and assurance, when you start looking at what's happening within the profession, that there's a whole raft of changes coming down the line for the UK audit profession as a result of a number of audit failings.
This is something that gets us quite excited in our world of auditing, Ginny, isn't it? And I've seen it advertised as a once in a lifetime reform of the auditing profession. And then when I looked at it, I thought, well, maybe that was a bit of an overstatement, but clearly there are big developments in our world. And this is all something on the back of the government getting a report called the Bryden Report that kind of detailed some of the failings that have happened with big household name firms and looking at the auditor's role in that and then thinking about what might be changing. So I don't know if you've got any more insight into what might be on the horizon on the back of that.
I think there's been a few things sort of coming down the line, one of which is the idea of saying, do we need to have two audit firms? Does that help at all? A large firm and a challenger firm. So that was one idea. There's a lot more around being clear as to what we do. So you know, if you look at an audit report, it's pretty full of jargon. It's pretty much impenetrable if you don't speak audit. Now, Ben and I are fluent in the language of audit, but if you don't speak it and somebody's reading it, it's not always clear what's going on there. And one of the ideas is saying, well, does it need to be clearer? Does it need to explicitly say, this is what we have done, this is what we have not done, this is what we are going to do? And so those are some of the things just to have a think about.
A good point in the chat box, an audit of the auditors. And there is regulation of auditors. At the moment, audit firms are regulated by the Financial Reporting Council. And they're the people that have been investigating and are the ones that levy the fines. But they're actually being replaced. I think the guidance is that they are maybe not as fit for purpose as the public would expect. So we're getting a new regulator, rather excitingly called the Audit Reporting and Governance Authority. So we'll wait and see how they change the regulation of our profession.
That they're being described as having teeth, which I love as an expression. So AGA will have teeth.
But I think you're right, not to go into loads more detail around this, because we're as always running out of time on the podcast. But when I looked at the BBC article this morning on the fine of one of the firms, the Financial Reporting Council had released a statement that was published on the BBC website. And I thought, I've read that as a tutor, and I think I probably understand what they mean. But for any non-auditing person reading that, I don't think they would have a clue what was going on. So, Ginny, maybe I could read an extract from it to you, and you could give us your professional insight into what exactly this audit firm maybe had been kind of hauled up on.
Shall I translate it into English?
Translate it into English. That would be fantastic. So, guys, if you're doing an audit paper in the coming weeks, months, or within the next couple of years, I say sound like an auditor. This is Ginny's help in you kind of sounding like an auditor. So the article said, in several material instances, what do we mean by a material instance?
Would I notice? Would I care? So if my pay is £2 wrong, would I notice? Probably not. Would I care? Yeah, probably not. If my salary was £2,000 wrong, would I notice? Absolutely. Would I care? Absolutely. So that's the clear definition of material. Would I notice? Would I care?
So things people would have cared about, and therefore presumably the auditors should have looked at or scrutinised.
They should have noticed. They should have cared.
So there we go. In several material instances, the respondent failed to obtain sufficient and appropriate audit evidence. What the heck do they mean by sufficient and appropriate audit evidence?
Sufficient means enough. Have I got enough evidence? The bigger the risk, the more evidence I need. I always think about it, it's like a set of scales. There we go. So I've got lots of risk. I need loads of evidence to make it balance. Appropriate just means the right sort of evidence. So back to our yacht, it would be super and lovely if I could go and touch the yacht, because then I really, really, really know it exists. If the client says to me, absolutely the yacht exists, here's a photograph of it. If I just rely on that photograph, that could be the photograph of any yacht from anywhere, and that's not the right sort of evidence.
Fantastic. And their final statement was, and they failed to apply sufficient professional scepticism in their conclusions.
So they didn't challenge based on what was in front of them. They didn't sit there and go, yeah, that's not in line with my expectations, or yeah, that doesn't feel right based on my knowledge of the business and my understanding of what should be there.
So just summing up that translation, what they could have said was, in areas that were big enough to worry people reading the accounts, they should have done more evidence gathering or done testing or ways of gathering that evidence in a more appropriate way. And they should have asked more detailed questions and maybe not relied on the directors so much for the evidence that they got during the audit.
Yeah, or even more brief, on the big risky things, they should have done more work.
There we go. Why don't they say things like that for the public to read? Dave, have we won you round? Do you see there is still a place for audit in our world and in the world of our syllabuses and students' education?
Well, the first thing I just want to say there is that Ginny very, very cleverly took a load of words that no one really understands and put them into a phrase that everyone could understand. And it does make me question the standards of financial journalism that we have, where our national broadcaster is just verbatim copying the statement without actually seemingly to understand what it means. And I think maybe they should use Ginny as some kind of consultant to come on and interpret those things so that they can be written in plain English, so that people can actually understand them. Because I think a lot of the mysticism around and the skepticism that the public have of auditors comes from them not understanding what auditors do. And auditors are very good at defending themselves and saying, oh no, we do exactly what we're supposed to do. We're not supposed to do that. But the public who put their trust in our systems don't understand what it is that auditors do compared to other fields of accountancy. So I think that better journalism and better explaining, and that's something we can all help with. We can all help by explaining our bit of finance in ways that people can understand. Do I think there's a need for auditing? Absolutely, I think there's a need for auditing. I look at the corporate collapses that have happened over recent times, the businesses that have failed, and seemingly the auditors really should have done a little bit more. So we saw Patisserie Valerie this week. There was also earlier this month a couple of news stories about the fallout from Carillion and the amount that their auditors are going to get fined on the back of the work that they didn't do correctly on Carillion's accounts. So I think absolutely there's a need for auditing. Would I want to go back to doing auditing again? That's a definite hard no from me, Ben. I think, as we talked about, it's very exciting going to new places every week and finding out how they operate. For me, when I started training, that was very, very exciting. I think I get a lot more excitement right now from seeing my students develop over time. And I would hate to kind of go back to seeing a new workplace and having that very transient experience of being in one place one week, one place another week, another place another week, but never really feeling like you have a home. I'm much happier having my own home and seeing the people around me grow.
So I think that's as warm as I've heard him speak about audit, Ginny, since I've known Ben.
I think that's we're on the edge there, Ben. We're definitely teetering on the edge.
I think we can mark that up as a tick and some progress made.
If it's an audit file, when I was training, that would have been a green tick. I'm so old, we had pen and paper.
We are rapidly running out of time, so we're going to have to wind up tonight's live student forum. Ginny, thank you so much for coming back and being the friend of the forum and the podcast that you are. You are welcome anytime, and you are so interesting on any subject that we can definitely have you back multiple times.
Thank you very much for the new email signature, which I will be changing.
Dave, is there any final thoughts from you before we wind up the podcast?
Likewise, I want to extend my thanks to Ginny, a wonderful guest as she was last time. If anyone hasn't heard Ginny's earlier podcast, do go back through the archives and be sure to listen to it. Thanks to everyone for choosing to download, to listen wherever you are. If you could take a moment to like it, to leave a review or share it with your friends who might be studying or friends that aren't studying. We just want to get kind of our messages out and to as many people as possible, because we know that there are lots and lots of students and also non-students there that would really benefit from hearing particularly stories about audit, Ben. But I think I'll leave it to you to wrap up for today, and I'll see you next week, Ben. And I know we've got a guest next week, but I think we'll leave that until the emails go out at the beginning part of next week to announce who that guest is. But I think we have got quite a special guest lined up.
Thank you, Dave. So yeah, go back and check out the previous episodes. you don't have to listen to all of them, but you can pick and choose now. There is such a selection that I'm sure there is a topic for everybody. Look after yourselves, look after each other, and we will see you on the next episode of the First Intuition Podcast. Bye-bye, everybody.